WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Gail Harris, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. With the national media fixated on the Bush-Kerry matchup, not much attention has been paid to November's Senate races. But with 34 seats up for grabs, eight of them with no incumbent, the battle for control of the Senate is heating up. At first, it looked as if Republicans stood to gain the most, with five Democratic senators in conservative southern states retiring, and the three Republican retirements coming in right-leaning states. But recent developments, like the emergence of strong Democratic candidates in Illinois and Colorado, fiery Republican primary battles in Florida and Pennsylvania, and the surprising weakness of incumbents like Lisa Murkowski of Alaska and Tom Daschle of South Dakota, have made control of the Senate post November 2nd anybody's guess. Tonight on Point, the upcoming Senate showdown. We begin in Hershey, Pennsylvania, where President Bush campaigned today with four-term Republican Senator Arlen Specter. WITF Harrisburg News Director Scott Gilbert was there to hear those speeches. I asked him to describe Senator Specter's main primary challenger, Pennsylvania Congressman Pat Toomey.
Congressman Pat Toomey is from the Lehigh Valley. That is, he's from the Allentown portion of Pennsylvania. He's attacking Specter as a liberal with a track record of failing to carry out true conservative ideals. Toomey says he is the one, in fact, who carries throughout the true wishes of the Republican Party. However, Toomey does say there is one time when Specter does vote more Republican than usual, and that is around election time. He refers to this as the Specter two-step. Specter maintains that this is not the case, and he merely votes on each issue as it comes up. He promotes his seniority as a four-term senator and his clout within the Senate as great reasons for him to be elected. He says this can only mean good things when it comes to landing funding for Pennsylvania projects, as it has in the past.
Scott, who are Toomey's major supporters?
The supporter getting the most play in the media right now is the Club for Growth. They're an anti-tax group. In fact, they're Toomey's biggest financial backer, and they agree with everything that Toomey says about Specter being too far, way too moderate and way too liberal, in fact, on several issues. They are backing Toomey because they say that it's time to really send a message to Republicans everywhere that this kind of moderate behavior from lawmakers in Washington that does not represent the ideals of the Republican Party, in their opinion, that this kind of behavior won't stand.
Well, from a distance, it does seem as if Specter has been trying to walk this fine line there. He touts his record on fighting crime. He's been endorsed by the National Rifle Association. But he also talks a lot about all the federal money that he's able to bring to Pennsylvania. So is he viewed as someone who has been good to the state, or do you think people are buying Toomey's complaint about how he's not really conservative enough?
Most analysts agree that no lawmaker knows Pennsylvania better than Arlen Specter. He makes it a point in the so-called off-season in Washington to travel throughout Pennsylvania and to visit every single county. He reminds people at every stop of his connections in Washington, especially around campaigning and around election time. He makes no secret of the fact that he has the backing of President Bush, of Vice President Cheney, that he is, of course, endorsed by his fellow Senator, U.S. Senator from Pennsylvania, Rick Santorum. His critics call him a wasteful spender, but Specter says, no, I simply bring home money for Pennsylvania. And as he's poised to possibly become the head of the Senate Appropriations Committee, if elected, he says that that is all the more reason that Pennsylvanians need an advocate like him reelected to become the first fifth-term senator in Pennsylvania's history.
And in fact, many of Specter's ads have a tagline that says, Pat Toomey, he's not far right, he's far out.
Right.
How effective is that?
Well, it's funny you mention that, because Senator Rick Santorum, the junior senator from Pennsylvania, is viewed as much more conservative than Specter in several circles. However, Specter says the way that Pat Toomey is acting makes Senator Santorum look like a liberal. It's been like this for several months. It's been a matter of, I best represent the Republican Party. No, I best represent the Republican Party. It's seen across the country as a battle for the soul of the GOP here in Pennsylvania.
Let's look forward from next Tuesday for a moment at the general election, because obviously Toomey or Specter is going to come out of this primary. They're going to be challenging the Democratic representative, Joe Huffel. Who's going to be the favorite there?
It's very hard to say, because both Toomey and Spector right now, as anyone consuming media anywhere in Pennsylvania could tell you, they're spending every campaign dollar they have, or they will close to it by the time next Tuesday rolls around, which means it's time for whoever wins to start the work once again on rebuilding a campaign war chest to face Democratic Congressman Joe Huffle. Most analysts agree that Huffle is relatively a political unknown at this point in Pennsylvania. But then again, many of those same analysts were saying the same thing about Toomey just months ago. And polls lately have seen Toomey closing in on Spector. Most put him about 10 percentage points or so behind the senior U.S. senator. However, it's still seen as the toughest fight of Spector's life.
And what about the turnout, Scott? Is that really what it's going to come down to next Tuesday?
Many say it is about whether Congressman Pat Toomey can incite more conservative Republicans to get out to the polls, or whether Senator Arlen Specter can get those moderate Republicans and even some would say liberals out to the polls next Tuesday. It's not so much just about getting the ideas across, but also both of these candidates are making it clear in their appearances that they want people to go to the polls. It's such a simple concept. It's not just about the issues. It's about energizing the base, that concept we've heard so much with the presidential election. And we're hearing it quite a bit here in Pennsylvania as well with this particular race, with both candidates trying to get the voters most likely to pull the lever with their name on it next Tuesday.
And do you get the sense that President Bush's appearance today for Senator Spector will make a difference?
Today's appearance is another tool that Senator Arlen Specter is using to say, listen, I have the backing of some very important Republicans, and one of them just happens to be the President of the United States. He touts that fact at every turn. He mentions Vice President Cheney's support. He mentions his fellow Senator Rick Santorum's support at every chance he can. And today's appearance, as well as tonight's appearance by President Bush at a fundraiser for Senator Arlen Specter in Pittsburgh, are really meant to drive home that point, or so the Spector campaign hopes.
Thanks very much, Scott.
You're welcome.
Scott Gilbert is the news director for WITF Harrisburg. He spoke with me today from Hershey, Pennsylvania. And we're talking this hour about the 34 Senate battles being fought around the country. 5 retiring Democrats, 3 retiring Republicans. Close contests in Alaska, Pennsylvania, Colorado. Have you been following these races? Is there one in your state? What do you look for in a senator? The same things you look for in a president, or something different? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now from Washington, D.C. is Terrence Samuel. He is chief congressional correspondent for U.S. News and World Report and a columnist for The American Prospect. Hi, Terrence.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And also joining me from Washington is Ramesh Panuru. He is senior editor at the National Review Magazine. Welcome, Ramesh.
Thank you for having me.
And joining us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is Jack Beatty, On Point's news analyst and a senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack. Always a pleasure to have you.
Always a pleasure to be on with you, Gail. Thank you.
Well, gentlemen, let me go to Washington first. I want to get into some specifics in just a moment. But first, give us the big picture here in terms of the presidential candidates. Will John Kerry have coattails for the Senate candidates to cling to? Will George Bush? Terrence, you want to start us?
It depends on what we're talking about, obviously. John Kerry may have coattails in Illinois, where Democrats may not need it as much, but that's the case. The question is, I think a larger question is whether the president will have coattails in places where he's expected to, meaning, in this case, the South, North Carolina, South Carolina, Florida, crucial Senate races up for grabs, and he's going to need to help his candidates in those places, particularly at this point where the races are much closer than anybody thought they would be.
Certainly at this point. Ramesh, how do you see the coattail question?
Well, I think it would need to have a fairly lopsided outcome in the presidential race before it would begin to have an effect. For instance, Bush would really need to win fairly convincingly, I think, to be able to help a Republican candidate in a fairly Democratic state such as Illinois. But if to the extent that there are coattails, the upside potential is greater for the Republicans because there's more Democratic senators in Bush states than there are Republican senators in states that went for Gore last time.
All right. Well, let's narrow our gaze just a bit here. There are 3 open seats that were held by Republicans, 5 held by Democrats. Where are those? And Terrence, how do you think they look?
Well, let's start with the Democrats. The Democrats initially had 5 senators announced that they would not seek re-election, that they would retire from the Senate. And it was a terrible day every time one of them announced, because they were all in red states, as Ramesh announced, Florida, South Carolina, North Carolina, Louisiana, and Georgia. All of those states went for Bush, and the question was, how would Democrats be able to hold on to those states? And the answer was, very frankly, they were going to have a difficult time. It seems at this point that in 4 of those 5, excepting Georgia, they are running pretty competitive races, and in a number of cases, looks like, at this point, looks like they might win.
And Ramesh, how do you see it?
I agree. I think that, this was not, the retirements did not create slam dunk wins for the Republicans. In South Carolina, you still have, for instance, a fairly divisive Republican primary. And as Tenenbaum, the Democratic likely candidate, seems fairly strong. And you can, you have similar stories in some of these other races. But of course, Republicans never figured they were going to sweep all of these races. They just thought every seat they win, is a pickup.
Mm. Although I do remember
The other side of that, though, to continue the relatively bad news for the Republicans, is that in Oklahoma, Colorado, and Illinois, Republican seats that should have been fairly, excepting Illinois, should have been fairly easy to keep, it looks like they're in trouble in 2 of those 3. Democrats are having trouble in Georgia. Democrats are having trouble in South Dakota. And that is a particularly crucial one, because that is where Tom Daschle, the Senate Democratic leader, is in the fight for his life against former Representative John Thune, who lost an election 2 years ago to the other Democratic senator from South Dakota, Tim Johnson, by a mere 524 votes. You suddenly have a well-known candidate fresh off a campaign 2 years ago versus Daschle 6 years ago, and the question is, can Daschle hold on?
And, of course, that's a very Republican state and presidential elections.
I want to bring Jack Beatty into the conversation. Jack, how do you see this playing out, and what do you think is at stake here?
Well, I'm concerned, or I think that one factor here are sort of reverse coattails. That is the Kerry factor. These 5 Democrats in the South, or if there are 4 of them who are viable, are going to have to be running with John Kerry of Massachusetts at the top of the ticket. And that might not be all that comfortable for him. And Kerry in the primary has said, well, maybe we can win without the South, which would just essentially be ignoring the South. Mm-hmm. So when Mike Dukakis ran in 88, I saw him down there at a rally in Atlanta, and Sam Nunn and Zell Miller introduced him as if he were an alien species.
Well,
the one thing I have to say about that is I think Southern Democrats have learned how to distance themselves from the presidential candidate so well that at this point they may even help him by running so well. I mean, I know Tenenbaum in South Carolina won her last election, and I acknowledge here that it was an election for education commissioner, but she got more votes than the current governor, than the current U.S. senator. So she is, in her own right, a political force, and I don't think she's going to have to worry that much about John Kerry.
All right. Well, gentlemen, hold the thought. There's lots more to be said on this topic. We're talking this hour about Senate races across the country, and we're asking you, whom do you want to see in the Senate come November 3rd? How do you decide? And what's at stake in this election? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harris sitting in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about this year's Senate matchups. Who's likely to win and why it matters? What issues are important to you in choosing your senator? Do you vote a straight party line? Do you like power in Washington to be in the hands of one party or split between the two? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're talking with Ramesh Panuru, senior editor at National Review, and Terrence Samuel, chief congressional correspondent at U.S. News and World Report and a columnist for The American Prospect. And joining us also, as usual, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Ramesh, I want to start with you on a question about how this plays out in terms of issues. What does it mean if your side wins? For example, we saw this kind of tug of war going on in the Pennsylvania primary between a moderate versus a much more conservative Republican. So what are Republicans really hoping for? What's their best outcome?
Well, it depends on which Republican you talk to, of course. A lot of Republican Party strategists are hoping that Arlen Specter wins that race because they think he'd be a stronger candidate in the fall, and what they mainly want is to pad their majority in the Senate, or at least, you know, if things go badly, to maintain control of the Senate. Of course, it's other people take a different view. They, you know, the Senate is not like the U.S. House, where when you have a majority, you can really do a lot of things. The Senate, you really do, you know, nobody really sort of controls the Senate the same way.
But do you see this as a feeling among conservative Republicans in particular that, gosh, not only could we pick up a few seats for the GOP, but we really could fill them with conservatives?
I think that is true. I think that even if you, I mean, the headline race intra-Republican is the Pennsylvania Senate race, Toomey versus Specter. But even if you look beyond that race, you look at the seats that Republicans might lose. The Ben Nighthorse Campbell seat in Colorado, Specter of Toomey were to win, Murkowski in Alaska. And then you look at some of the people that who might be replacing them. Very possibly Tom Coburn in Oklahoma, David Vitter in Louisiana. You have a much more conservative field running, and it's quite possible that even if the Republicans stay even or even lose a seat, you'll have more conservative votes in the Senate next year.
All right, Terrence, and how does that play out on the Democratic side? Five open Democratic seats. What does it mean to the Democrats if they win big?
Well, if they win big, I mean, they have a recent example of what it means to be in power in the Senate with a Republican president, and then suddenly a reminder of what it means not to have that power. And I speak here, of course, of the what I refer to as the Jeffords majority that the Democrats enjoyed for a few months from 2001 to the 2002 midterms.
Although he's technically an independent.
He is technically an independent, but he left the Republican Party, and that swung the majority to the Democrat. What they understand is that they had a chance to stop President Bush advancing a lot of his agenda that they disagreed with. I think a lot of them now think that they should have been more forceful in their stopping or at least advancing their own agenda. This is the Democrats don't control any of the levers of power in Washington, and this would be a place where they can get a chance to do that. And they desperately, and I don't use the word ill-advisedly, they are desperately looking for a way to get back into the game and challenge the president.
They'd sure like to have those committee chairmanships back.
It doesn't hurt.
All right, Jack, it's always fun to talk about the horse race aspects here, but let's get to issues for a moment. How do you see the war in Iraq playing here and the economy? I mean, is it possible for someone to be very happily voting for George Bush and for Tom Daschle if you're in South Dakota?
Well, they're going to be put to that, aren't they? And unlike Tim Johnson in 2002, Tom Daschle voted no on the Iraq War resolution, and he voted no on the Bush tax cuts of 2001. So he's going to be he's much more construable as an ideological opponent of Bush, and Bush got 61% of the vote in 2000 in South Dakota. So that's going to be a tough race. You know, Senate historians say the last time a Senate minority leader was unseated, you have to go back to 1952. So this doesn't happen all the time, but Thune has run statewide, came within a whisker, and could again. You know, there may be a kind of hidden hand in politics that works toward divided government. It is the case that for all but six of the last 35 years, we've had divided government in this country, either a Republican Senate, a Republican House, or a Democratic. Or in other words, one branch was or one of the houses, and the presidency was in different parties. So I don't know how that hidden hand works. Do people go to the polls and say, well, I'm going to vote for Daschle and Bush because I don't want the Republicans to have all the power? I don't think that's conscious, but yet you can't blink this effect of the settled preference Americans seem to have for divided government. And we haven't had more than two consecutive years of divided government, of single-party government for a long time. And that's one of the things that will be on the ballot.
Or I wonder if that even plays out, Jack and Terrence and Ramesh, in voters' minds as, well, I'm going to go with the president because I agree with him philosophically, but so-and-so senator has been very good for my state.
Well, I suspect that's what's going to happen in South Dakota for a lot of voters, that will, in fact, be able to pull the lever both for the president and Senator Daschle.
And I think that actually helps Senator Spector in Pennsylvania. I think a lot of people are going to vote against the president in Pennsylvania and vote for Senator Spector because they look at him, and even though Pennsylvania has never elected a four-term senator, and Spector's on the verge of number five, he has produced a lot of loot that he's taken home, and people appreciate that. The very argument that the conservatives and Toomey use against him, which is that he's a big spender, is actually what Spector's using to drive his campaign, which is, I deliver.
1-800-423-8255 is our number if you'd like to join the conversation. 1-800-423-TALK. And let's go to Quincy, Massachusetts now. We want to hear from Dennis, who's been waiting on the line. Hello, Dennis, and welcome.
Hello, thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I have a question for any of your guests. Really, I'm curious as to see how they see if the situation in Iraq continues to deteriorate, how that might play into the election since this is primarily seen as George Bush's agenda and a Republican agenda. Would they see a seriously deteriorating situation in Iraq influencing the elections at all in the fall?
All right. Thanks for the call, Dennis. And Ramesh, let me throw that one to you first.
Well, I think people's view of sort of how this is going to affect the elections is changing really month to month and even week to week. So it's very hard to say. This is something certainly that Republican strategists are very nervous about, partly because of the potential that the caller was alluding to, but also because it's relatively uncontrollable at this point. You know, there's no sort of smart political strategy that would contain that damage if things get worse over there.
And Terrence, I wonder how you see that playing out, and also whether you think that voters will make that decision based on whatever the news from Iraq is in late October, or whether it will be a cumulative impact of the war and the post-war environment that will make that decision for them.
I think the war in Iraq is something that just naturally forces people toward a certain kind of moderate view, modulated view of the world. They don't want to be rash about how they decide politically on what's happening in Iraq. So I think they're taking it very slowly. They've given the president the benefit of the doubt. I think they continue, for the most part, to give the president the benefit of the doubt. What could happen here, what the Republican strategists fear, is that suddenly there is something or some tide that turns against the president, and this turns into a runaway that people are just completely not interested in anything he has to say about the war because they just don't believe in him, anymore. We haven't seen that develop. Could it happen? Certainly. I think for the most part what you're going to have is people making very considered judgments about how to vote on this come November. It can help the president, and it can hurt his critics if anybody goes too far on this.
All right. Jack, you're always so good on putting things in a historical perspective for us. So what do you see as a parallel here, or is there one?
Well, just quickly going through my mind here, candidates have lost in, you know, war and peace has cost candidates seats. But often, at least it's my recollection, in the wave of them in the late 60s and 70s, in primaries, where you could get a, you know, a hard, especially Democratic primaries in the North, where, you know, a lot of people who voted for Lyndon Johnson's war, both senators and congressmen, lost their seats in primaries. In general elections, however, it's a trickier matter for the reasons these gentlemen were saying. And, you know, there are only two incumbents here who are going to have to answer for their votes. Tom Daschle, who voted no, and 6 months ago that probably looked like a negative, but I can't imagine that's going to – he's going to look prescient now, it seems to me, given the horrors of Iraq, of this occupation. And I believe he voted for the $87 billion funding for the troops. So he's on the –
He did, Jack.
Yeah, he's got the right position there. I thought I was skeptical about the war, but I support the troops. That's a tough one to hang him with. And then in Alaska, Murkowski voted for the war, but I just don't know if Alaska is the kind of, you know, it just doesn't, from what I know about it, which is nothing, I wouldn't imagine that it would be a kind of rallying issue out there one way or another.
Yeah, I want to ask, who's my Alaska expert here? Because it's a fascinating story that I frankly didn't know that much about. Lisa Murkowski was appointed to the seat by her father, the former governor, or the governor.
I'll take it. I won't claim expert status, but I think what you have happening in Alaska is kind of a, you know, state politics is just always so interesting. And there is the economy, there is the war, there is all of this stuff going on. And Lisa Murkowski has suddenly a challenge from the right, from the former chairman of the Senate. President of the Senate, I'm sorry, Mike Miller, who is saying that she's not conservative enough. And in addition, he claims, she was appointed by her dad. So there's this nepotism thing hanging over this race. And Republicans may lose the seat to former Governor Tony Knowles, who is a terrific candidate, because of this nepotism thing.
All right. Ramesh, do you have a favorite race that you're tracking? Some good stories?
Well, the thing is, you know, I was thinking about the sort of the national picture. I think by September, October, they're going to be, you know, by Labor Day, there'll probably be six or seven on each side that the other party's really looking at. And then by actually Election Day, we'll actually be wondering how three or four, or maybe five or six of them end up turning out. And so you kind of have to wait and see, you know, what's going to happen. I mean, I think the Oklahoma race, for instance, could be very interesting because there you have a very smart and capable Democratic candidate who's in the person of Brad Carson, a congressman, who's going to try to run for Senate in a state that isn't all that capable. I mean, isn't all that congenial to the Democrats. And it's going to be really interesting to see if he can make that work.
All right, 1-800-423-8255 is our number. If you'd like to join the conversation, we'd be happy to hear from you. We're going now to Wisconsin, to Osseo, I believe that's right. Bruce, hi, welcome.
Thank you very much. I guess my opinion is I think it's really important that we have a Democratic Senate because it seems to me that the Republicans have been really just shameless in their process of what I consider as undermining democracy by the way they operated in committee, both doing things in secret, changing bills that were deleting items, and I understand from pressure from the White House, that were actually voted on and agreed to by both houses, and they deleted those in committee and then sent those bills on to the president to be signed. And I think democracy only works when it's out in the open, and they seem to be operating so much in secret.
And, Bruce, I'm leafing through my papers here, and I see that Russ Feingold is the incumbent who's up for election. How's he doing?
I think he's doing well. He's pretty much to the left, but, he's pretty liberal. But I think the thing about Feingold is, and it's you can always live with a guy if he says what he means and means what he says, and that's one of the things that has been really true about Russ Feingold.
All right. Thanks very much for the call, Bruce. Let me put that question to Terrence. As to his point about how the process works, the perception of people as to who's doing what behind closed doors. I mean, is that something that really voters are keenly aware of, or is that something that they pick up from negative heads from their opponents?
I don't think voters are sufficiently aware of how nasty it's gotten here. It is really an unbelievably partisan, and not just partisan, but acrimoniously partisan climate here in the Capitol. I mean, part of the problem that Republicans have is they're operating with such small margins in their majority. But in the Senate, somebody just once described it as herding cats. Well, what they didn't say is that, they were all lions. I mean, everybody in the Senate is a kingmaker. And because the margins are so small, more and more deals have to be made. Nobody feels in control. It's highly frustrating for the majority. And what you have is people just going to extraordinary lengths, say on the Medicare bill, to get what they need, what they think they need. It's fairly nasty.
Yeah, but the sort of overriding of, you might say, democratic processes, the Democrats have also been guilty of it. They've been filibustering federal judges, not all of them, but I think about four, and they've been threatening filibusters on other measures. Now, that's really where you get a situation where a minority of senators holds the majority at bay. And so I think both parties have been, have been forced to unusual devices to stay alive in this competitive climate.
So not just herding cats, herding yowling cats, sounds like. We're discussing this hour this year's Senate battles and what's at stake. Who's your favorite U.S. senator? Who would you like to see more of or less of? Do you vote the party or the person? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about the Senate fights gearing up around the country. Are the Senate races just Bush v. Kerry on a smaller scale, or is each Senate contest unique? What issues do you think these races will hinge on? National security, or jobs, or the environment? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're speaking with Terrence Samuel, Chief Congressional Correspondent for U.S. News and World Report, and Ramesh Panuru, a Senior Editor at National Review. And also with us is Jack Beatty, On Point's News Analyst. And gentlemen, I want to get back to something that we spoke about a little bit earlier in the program, and that was about the question in the South, in those red Republican states, as to whether voters there might be willing to embrace John Kerry. Could he solve that problem by putting a Southerner on the ticket? Terrence, you want to start?
Oh, boy, that's the problem is so huge that any solution is going to be partial at best and minuscule at most. I think there is a lot of talk about whether a John Edwards, for example, helps Kerry in the South. And the answer is it does. It probably forces the Bush campaign to campaign a little more in the South, but it's hard to see how Kerry wins any state in the South, even though there is a lot of talk about all the job losses in North and South Carolina, the huge outflow of textile jobs, and whether disenchantment with the war and concern about the economy can combine to create some kind of unseen wave that actually causes Kerry to win. If I had a dollar, I wouldn't bet more than 5 cents on that.
Yeah. Putting a Southerner on top of the ticket in 2000 didn't win the Democratic Party any of the Southern states. So I think it's going to be hard to make the argument that putting one in the vice presidential slot this time will. I think West Virginia is certainly up for grabs, and Florida, if you count those two Southern states. But you know, so the rational Democratic strategist is probably not going to be trying to, you know, pick up Alabama or Georgia. On the other hand, it may not be wise to advertise that fact too loudly, especially when you've got all of these Southern Senate races going this year.
So Republicans are not necessarily holding their breath in fear that a Southerner is going to be on the Democratic ticket.
That's right.
How does this play out in terms of the national parties? I mean, how do political parties make decisions at the national level in terms of where, what races they're going to target? Where are they going to pump in some additional money, some additional support, you know, summon the troops? What are the factors that go into that, Ramesh?
Well, I mean, there's fairly cold-blooded calculations of who they, you know, which races they think are viable and which aren't. And obviously, the calculation changes over time. If for instance, Toomey beats Specter in the Pennsylvania primary, then I think that there will be a lot of, you know, that's going to increase a demand on money. The Republicans are going to need to spend a lot more if they want to carry Pennsylvania, and they're going to have to decide, do we want to do that, or would we rather be spending this money in Colorado? Would we rather be spending this money in Georgia? And also don't forget that the person who runs the Republican Senate campaign committee, George Allen, is going to be under a lot of pressure from his colleagues, even those who aren't facing particularly tough reelection bids. All these incumbents will want him to give them money that he's going to want to prefer to give to challengers or to people running for open seats.
1-800-423-8255 is our number. Let's go to Riverton, Wyoming. We want to hear from Ted. Hello, Ted. Welcome.
Hi. Great show. Two quick comments. One of your guests said that pointed out that the Democrats are blocking appointments to the federal bench. I'd like to point out that to criticize the Democrats for this is really inappropriate because the Republicans did the same thing for 8 years under the Clinton administration. There were over 100 vacancies on the federal bench because Republicans blocked Clinton appointments. Anything the Democrats are doing now is far less than what the Republicans got away with for 8 years, but the Democrats didn't make an issue of it. Secondly, the way this is going to affect my vote is I'm going to try and put as many Democratic senators in office as possible because I think blocking the Bush administration appointees to the bench is critical. I don't think there's been an administration in the last 50 years that's trampled on American rights and civil liberties more than the Bush administration, and I think it's unconscionable. And to me, that's going to be a major factor influencing my vote.
Well, is it more than your vote? Are you involved in politics now, Ted?
As much as I can be, yes.
But as a citizen, I mean, you're not part of a campaign for any person in particular?
No, as a citizen and as someone who contributes to campaigns.
All right. Thanks so much. Appreciate the call. Ramesh, you want to respond to that?
Oh, well, it would be, you know, getting into the who started it fight is a little unproductive. All I would say is if you're talking specifically about filibusters, there were no Republican filibusters against judges where you were denying these nominees floor votes. And, in fact, Clinton's two Supreme Court nominees both sailed through with a majority of the Republican senators supporting them. But I would just say that the whole point discussion of filibuster brings me back to the point I was making earlier, which is, you know, I was saying that sort of merely having 51 votes in the Senate doesn't really guarantee you a lot because of the herding cats problem. But the really significant threshold would be if either party got to about 60, where they would be able to actually shut down filibusters much more easily.
Terrence, I don't know how long you've been covering Congress, but I know with each race, we're always tempted to say, oh, this is truly an enormous turning point. Do you see this time as truly being crucial?
Yes and no. How's that for a definitive answer?
You've got a career in public radio.
Thank you, sir. I think what a lot of people are looking for is some kind of break in this logjam that Jack mentioned, both parties being just driven to these completely desperate means just to make a point. Clearly the Democrats think that some of these judges were not qualified or too ideological and shouldn't be on the bench. But in a lot of cases, what they were doing is just sending a message to the president that, you're not going to just run over us here, which is something that they really feel had been happening. And I think a lot of people are just looking for, for Rick Santorum to be supporting Arlen Specter over Pat Toomey, who is practically a clone of Santorum on the issues, is a complete admission on Santorum's part that what he wants is to hold on to the majority. In fact, he told me that. He says, I think this is the best chance for us to hold our seat. Arlen Specter comes from a different part of the state. We come from a different place politically. But I want to be in the majority here because that's important to me. And the question is, at what point does that, having that override, kind of the basic ideological issues become important? And for people who certainly in the Senate, they think that time is now. Certainly people who are opposing Specter think that this is an opportunity with a Republican president, a Republican House, and nominally Republican Senate, that this is a chance to advance a conservative agenda that they think the country supports and Arlen Specter doesn't.
Jack Beatty, I want to give you the last word here. Do you see this as a pivotal race?
You mean these Senate races?
Yes.
I don't think either party can get to 60. And so in that sense, it isn't pivotal because, the Democrats have said that they may even filibuster a Supreme Court nominee. If the Republicans got to 60, they couldn't do that. So I don't know that it's not decisive in that respect. But it's always important. And these votes, I am a Senate. I regret the Senate, I must say. I mean, talk about an anti-democratic institution. The cows in Wyoming, where our good voter just called from, get so much more of a bump in the Senate than New York City. But anyway, that's what we live with the Senate, and it's our House of Lords. And some of the lords and ladies are going to lose their job.
Well, we thank you all for helping us put it in perspective. Terrence Samuel, Ramesh Panuru, Jack Beatty. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you.
You can continue the conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In just a moment, why Kenyan runners continue to dominate the sport of marathon running. This is On Point. The Kenyans continued their domination of the prestigious Boston Marathon today, sweeping the top four spots on the men's side and winning the women's side for the fourth time in the past 5 years. The top American man finished 13th, and the top American woman 16th. The utter dominance of Kenyan marathoners over the past decade has been remarkable. Journalist John Manners has tracked the rise of Kenya's running empire. In this radio diary, he explains why a small, poor African nation has been able to rule the sport of running.
I grew up about 200 yards from Heartbreak Hill, and I ran the Boston Marathon myself way back in 1975 when the qualifying standards were a little more lenient. But I only really became interested in the event in the early 1990s when Kenyans began running it in significant numbers. Since then, since 1991 to be precise, Kenyans have won 13 of the 14 men's races and 4 of the past 5 women's. Today's men's race was pretty typical. Kenyans took the first 4 places and 7 of the top 10. Kenyans put up similar numbers in the world's other major marathons and road races. And this raises an obvious question about a relatively small developing country in the middle of the world's most destitute region. Why are the Kenyans so good? And you might ask, what does it matter to me? Well, the second question is fairly easy. I used to live in Kenya. I spent a year there when I was 12, tagging along with my father, who was doing anthropological fieldwork among a tribe called the Kalenjin. And after college, I went back to the same small corner of the country for 3 years as a Peace Corps teacher and track coach. When I went back to Kenya in the Peace Corps, it was no accident that I was assigned to a secondary school in Kalenjin country. I requested it. It was common knowledge in Kenya that the Kalenjin were the best runners. Well, what was true in Kenya then is true worldwide now. For example, in today's race, 6 of the 7 Kenyans in the top 10 were Kalenjin. In fact, about half of all the biggest distinctions in the sport, major championship medals, world records, world rankings, belong to Kalenjin. The success of the Kalenjin has been the subject of quite a bit of published speculation, including my own. There are some obvious factors. One is altitude. Like most Kenyans, practically all of the 3 million Kalenjin live at elevations above 5,000 feet, where the thin air fosters the development of strong hearts and lungs and raises the proportion of oxygen-carrying red cells in the blood. Another factor is poverty. Kenya is a poor country. Per capita income is less than $2,000 a year. There are very few private cars or TV sets. So Kenyan kids spend most of their time running around outdoors, not to mention running back and forth to school. And until they're in their teens, most Kenyan kids do most of their running barefoot. All this no doubt conditions their feet and legs to the kind of punishment distance runners have to put themselves through. And of course, with a per capita income about 1/20th that of Americans, Kenyans have a strong incentive to exert themselves for rewards that would not tempt most Westerners. A second-rank road racer in America, for example, can expect to take in between $10,000 and $30,000 in a year. There aren't many Americans willing to train 100 or more punishing miles a week for that. But altitude and poverty are scarcely unique to Kenya, let alone the Kalenjin. What accounts for the extraordinary success of this one small group? There may be cultural factors. The Kalenjin are a warrior tribe that places a great premium on courage and stoicism. Their adolescent initiation rituals, a slow, painful circumcision watched over by elders looking for the slightest flinch that will brand a boy a coward for life, are more arduous and invested with more significance than comparable rituals in most other East African groups. And, of course, there's the possibility that the Kalenjin have developed collective genetic traits that turn out to be helpful in competitive distance running. Research in this area is still at a rudimentary stage. The best work to date has been done by a Danish team who found that Kalenjin success could be put down largely to the runner's economy, that is, the efficiency with which they use the oxygen they take in. The Danes concluded that the extraordinary economy of the Kalenjin results from their inordinately skinny calves, far less lifting to do over the course of a long race. This conclusion strikes me as overly simplistic, but it's a first step in what's likely to be a long series of studies that will tell us a little more definitively why, around this time 20 years from now, Kalenjin runners will have just won their 25th of the past 27 Boston marathons.
John Manners is a journalist with a longtime specialty in Kenyan running and is also the father of On Point producer Jane Manners. He lives in Montclair, New Jersey. I'm Gail Harris, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.